Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public service professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Tim Kelly, Mark Vaviades, and Karen Sigmund. Our program coming to you from our studios at Westwood One in beautiful Culver City, California, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to tweet us a question, it's at BTB Dumont, at BTB Dumont. And again, it's nice to be with you on a beautiful Sunday afternoon in Southern California. And we've got a primary focus tonight is on the heart and soul for the Republican Party, the battle that is going on. We certainly want to put it in context with some of the big news this past week, a significant development, at least in my view, in the view of many, in the Benghazi investigation. It appears that the trail does lead to the White House, and we'll talk about the significance of that and whether or not the national media will give it the type of coverage that it deserves. That'll be part of what will be discussed. And in the second hour, we're going to be joined by a reporter who's doing a story on Elizabeth Warren, and really the topic of hour number two, at least a portion of it, will be, what if Hillary Clinton decides not to run? What will happen? Who's in the wings? So that's coming up in the second hour. But in the first hour, we're going to be talking about Republican politics, naming names, coming up with a variety of options for the Republican Party. But wherever you are listening, if you consider yourself a Republican or an independent, and you have a choice or some advice for the Republican leadership, do give us a call. And of course, the Republican leadership, that is a debatable point. Perhaps that's an oxymoron, and we want to get your reaction to that as the program unfolds this evening. 1-800-723-8289. Let me begin by talking about the latest development with Benghazi. And I want to ask Karen Sigmund, who's been following this story. Mm-hmm. She's been active in the Tea Party, also Rage Against the Media is an organization that you head.
Right.
Your reaction about Benghazi. Is it the smoking gun that Republicans have hoped for and prayed for? And if it is, what's going to happen with it?
Well, I think there's two parts of everything to do with Benghazi, if not more. One of them is, of course, how did this even come about? How did what precipitated the attack, and how did we not honor their requests for increased security? Apparently, in the weeks, days, and even hours that led up to that attack, that predicted attack on September 11th of 2012, we knew this was going to happen. How is it that they refused the assistance that had been requested? Mm-hmm. So that we have not gotten an answer to. The second part was the cover-up, mm-hmm. and what we're finding now is the smoking gun to the cover-up, the deliberate blaming of this predicted attack on a YouTube video, even though as it was occurring and even beforehand, they knew a YouTube video had nothing to do with it.
Also with us this evening is the chairman of the Republican Party of Los Angeles, Mark Vaviades. Mark, nice to have you back with the broadcast.
Thank you, Bruce.
The way in which Karen has set this up, do we have a trail of political problems in each area, where one part of this story about whether or not there was enough security there goes directly back to Secretary of State mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, and the second part of her controversy goes perhaps directly to the President of the United States, and that is the cover-up, cover your rear end, when you're a couple of months away from the election and you don't want the public to know the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And so Susan Rice is sent out there with a tail to spin, which turns out to be incorrect.
Yeah, and I'll go a step farther. When it comes to leading up to the events, I think it goes right to the White House as far as why that security wasn't there and why we didn't take action at the time. The White House and the Obama administration was trying to position Obama as someone who was successful in the war against terror, successful with his foreign policies, and they didn't want it to look like Al-Qaeda was not 6 feet under. They wanted it to to be a video rather than an organized terrorist attack. They didn't.
So it's not a problem for Hillary Clinton, then?
It is a problem for Hillary Clinton, too. They're both to blame on that one. But I think they're working very closely together to let folks know that it was not a terrorist attack, that it was a video. And then after the event, they tried to make it look like it was because of the video that this happened, and they wanted to hopefully let that narrative continue and then go away.
Tim Kelly also joins us, Navy veteran, served in Vietnam. Thank you for your service, and also a longtime activist in the Republican Party at the county level.
Right.
Benghazi, is your reaction to the latest news last week, and do you think that this is a pony the Republicans should ride in 2016?
I think there's two issues here. One of them is that this was almost a classic federal bureaucratic train wreck, where if you trace it back, the state, intelligence, military, the actual people involved, everybody was dropping the ball right and left. And in a sense, this was Hillary's problem, although the trouble happened about four floors under her. And I doubt that she actually personally had any idea of it. Now this is a very serious problem. This is a serious problem, and a classic bureaucratic train wreck. But the political problem is not that. The government screw up a lot of things, and we get to the bottom of it. The political problem is the White House went beyond spin into creating out of whole cloth.
They lied.
They lied. And all kinds of bureaucrats and public servants and military officers and intelligence officers and Secretary of State Clinton, they all bungled. But none of them by themselves caused this or intended to cause it. And most of them have fessed up to this.
But the guy who lied about this, or who orchestrated, the administration that orchestrated it,
right,
doesn't go directly to the president yet. But it certainly goes close to those, the spinmeisters around him. It's pretty hard for the average person to get upset and exercise to try to. They can't punish Barack Obama anymore. I mean, he basically he played a card right before the election, and the American people fell for it.
Bought
hook,
it.
Line, and sinker. And then he had the audacity. Not of hope. He had the audacity in that debate when Mitt Romney made the suggestion that this might have been a case. He made Mitt Romney look like a fool, and the national media all jumped on Mitt Romney, making him look like someone who had spoken out of school. When, you know, we look right now, you know, there, Mitt Romney was right.
Right. And actually, let's take it back a little bit further to this completely more fabricated out of whole cloth, the Arab Spring. There was no such actual Arab Spring, and the attack on our mission in Benghazi was an obvious outcome of all of that. That was brought to us by Secretary of State Clinton and President Obama, and sold to us by the media. So, and the media has been complicit in this from every single step.
I want to get a reaction from everyone in Radioland to the first part of our discussion this evening, and that is, if you are a Republican, and we're going to honor system now, if you are a Republican, is Benghazi an issue that you think could turn the elections towards the Republicans, not only later this year congressionally, but in 2016? Give us a call. Back shortly from Culver City. From Sugarland, Texas to Sausalito, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029, coming to you tonight from beautiful Culver City, just a stone's throw from downtown Culver City. Before the break, I had asked everyone to sort of offer their thoughts and assessment of the impact of that issue. And Mark, you wanted to jump in on that in studio.
Yeah, my point was that this will only work for the Republicans if the media picks up on it. And when I say media other than Fox News. Because if Karen also mentioned that the Democrats may not participate in the hearings, that it may just be Republicans only, and that's quite planned, because if it's only Republicans, whether they're doing the right thing or not, it will look like a partisan event. And if the media other than Fox doesn't pick it up, then it's not going to be a story on the...
Do you think you mentioned that your organization, Rage Against the Media, was founded because of the early indication that the national media was not giving this story significant coverage?
Exactly. Well, even more so than that, not only were they not giving it significant coverage, but they were taking these exact talking points, they were taking the storyline from the White House and blaming this entire thing on the YouTube video. And people I know, smart people I know, were appalled at this young Californian for making such a YouTube video that would incite violence. This was the party line. Mm-hmm. This was the storyline told on the media, through the media, and this is what became the reality for too many people. And in fact, even now, was it our investigative journalists who broke this story? Not at all. It was Judicial Watch. Our media has not moved at all to find out the truth about any of this and are still not covering it. So I completely agree with Mark. It cannot be seen to be partisan, and the only way for this not to be partisan is for the media to pick up on it. And the only way the media picks up on it is either we get some kind of momentum going, which sometimes we think we see with Jonathan Carl, for example, from ABC, being so appalled at Jay Carney's obvious lie and spin mm-hmm. last week. Mm-hmm. And let's not forget, Ben Rhodes, who wrote these talking points, is the brother of David Rhodes, president of CBS. And let's not forget that Jay Carney, that man up there spinning as furiously as he could, is married to Claire Shipman of ABC. Mm-hmm. The incest that's going on here between the media and the administration is so atrocious. But I think if people... Rage Against the Media was born out of this, and we are the ones, among others, obviously,
fighting to keep this
in the public eye.
You've made a very important comment about the relationship and the coziness of the media and the White House and this administration, and that could not have been more clearly demonstrated if you watched any of the Sunday morning shows today. This bath of coverage about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, this love affair between the media and the president and political leadership, it makes me sick because these are the people that should be asking important questions and they're too busy socializing. And by the way, it's those right of center and left of center. Mm. It is an insular Washington thing. They don't want to miss the big party because if they miss the big party, they are less important. So they talked about the Washington A-listers. All showed up, and of course, half of them were brought in from Hollywood. They're so insecure, and they need to be part of that inside group. And every single day and every single year, when they have these events. This year's event, the one last night, the coverage today, the amount of coverage that went into that compared to any other story, any other significant story in the world, including the Benghazi. Meet the Press had it buried deep in the show. But it just is an example why, frankly, why there's programs like this mm-hmm. that exist and why there are organizations like Rage Against the Media that exist. But I can't believe that any smart news executive who watched all of those shows today could really believe that anyone in the heartland of America, or in many areas even not in the heartland, gives a rat's patoot about an inside party with after parties. It's like the Oscars, only for Washington. I can't believe that people think that is important, and some organizations, including the New York Times, which prohibits its people from going to the event, I have a great deal of respect for them. But everyone else, they're all in bed with one another, and they want their pictures, and they're taking selfies with each other. It's disgusting. These are the people that are supposed to be asking serious questions about what happens in our society. It's terrible. Everyone listening to this program today who feels that way, you should call your local television station, regardless of the affiliation, because they all did it. Mm-hmm. Ad nauseum, they're giving you a story about an inside Washington party, and other important issues are not being discussed.
That was a total non-story. I mean, not only was it a smaller story than what should have been up there, it was a non-story.
Right.
I was shocked to see any coverage of that.
It was a bath.
It was weird because on C-SPAN, it was like a TMZ or E-Channel deal. I mean, I was at an event and I taped it and watched it. And the commentary on CNN with Ben Stein and some of their people, they treated it as fluff. CNN people treated it as pure fluff. This had nothing to do with the government, nothing to do with real news. This was a fluffy event that belongs on the 7 to 8 o'clock entertainment shows. This was not politics. It didn't belong on C-SPAN.
Right.
I was appalled. I was just appalled by it.
Let's go to calls. Let's go to Charlotte listening on WLS in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Go ahead.
Hi. I think it's a good idea that we're pursuing the truth. We've had so much, with health care, the IRS scandal about a rogue group in Cincinnati, health care lies. But, it seems to me that who has been held responsible? Have they caught any of the terrorists that killed our four Americans? All I know is a filmmaker was picked up in the middle of the night, handcuffed, and carried off by the government. Is he still in jail?
No, he's not still in jail. And I think you're absolutely right. Why are we not pursuing the actual people behind the actual attack? Apparently, we did have some of them in custody early on in the beginning days of this.
But there has been some success in killing significantly high people within Al-Qaeda. I mean, the administration can get a slap in the face for a lot of things, but I don't think their aggressive pursuit of terrorism should be totally dismissed. I mean, they lead the league in drone attacks, so they're doing something.
Right, that is true. But let's also not forget that Hillary Clinton went up to, is his name Charles Woods, the father of Tyrone Woods, and promised to get the maker of that YouTube video and put him in jail. That was a promise that she made to this grieving father in front of his son's casket to put that YouTube video maker in jail, knowing full well this had not one thing to do with his YouTube video.
Rather than the people that killed her
Rather
son.
Than terrorism, rather than this was part of an attack on a U.S. ambassador that has not happened in decades, including his son. For her to lie to that man's face in front of his son's casket is the most reprehensible thing of all this that I can even imagine.
Michael, in Benton Harbor, Michigan, go ahead. You're on Beyond the Beltway. Are you there? Let us go to...
Right,
are you there?
Ready and willing to go.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. The Benghazi issue?
Yes.
If the Republicans don't have anything else to throw as mud, I guess they'll pick it. But I agree with George Washington when George Washington said two keys to a strong America. Number one, keep strong American borders. And number two, stay out of other countries' wars and squabbles. And Eisenhower, who said the military-industrial complex in 139 countries we have military in will bankrupt America. That's about all I have to say. I think Obama's doing a pretty good job. 9 million Americans getting health care, record high stock market for a socialist.
Do you believe, sir, that when the government screws up, regardless of who the president is, this has nothing about parties. When the government screws up, do you think that there is a responsibility of oversight by the media to find out who was responsible for that screw up, or do you just let it go because it happened yesterday?
Well, when you say media, are you talking about Fox, the Republican?
I'm talking about all news media collectively.
Well, that's the freedom of the press, absolutely, certainly. But I don't think there was that big of a screw up. I think it's just overblown, and it's just a campaign ploy by the Republicans and Tea Party.
Oh, really? So do you think we should ignore what happened in Benghazi? An attack on a consulate is an attack on our homeland, and we should go after those folks. And if there were people within the government who didn't do their due diligence in going after those people, then they need to be held accountable so this doesn't happen in the future.
We're moving on to Bryant in Redding, California. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Al, good evening. Couple of things. One, I think it is a good idea to go after the issue on Benghazi. But good. Also, I think the issue of Obamacare. Now, true, they have said, you know, so many people had gotten a insurance that they didn't have before. Yes, but by, I think probably about twice as many, if not more, lost insurance that they had before.
Yeah, well, I think you've named the other issue that is likely to come up, certainly in the congressional elections this year. I don't know whether it's going to come up much in 2016, but I think it will certainly dominate a lot of campaigns, as it already is. Thank you for your call, 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, every Sunday night, this is Bruce Dumont. And also, if you'd like to tweet us a question, it's at BTB Dumont, at BTB Dumont. Back with more calls and conversation tonight, live from Culver City, California. From Logan Square to Laguna Beach, California, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Coming to you tonight from Culver City, California. This will be our last broadcast from California for many, many months. Probably come back here towards the late end of the year, but this year. But again, we've had great broadcasts from California and enjoying doing the show from this beautiful Westwood One studio that we have just literally a stone's throw from downtown Culver City. We have interesting guests around the table this evening. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. Mark Vaviades. Mark, give us a little bit about your background for those listening coast to coast.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. I actually grew up in Massachusetts, and I was very involved with the Republican Party in Massachusetts for many years. I actually worked for the Governor Weld's administration, came out to California in 1998, very involved with the grassroots, including the Hollywood Republicans and the California Congress of Republicans, and now I'm the chairman of the Los Angeles County Republican Party.
And there's a lot of Hollywood Republicans.
Yes, there are, but they...
but they can't meet in public.
They are kind of secretive about themselves because they don't want to lose work in Hollywood.
And that does happen.
Oh, it certainly does.
Karen Sigmund joins us.
Hi, great to be here. I grew up in California, but spent 30 years on the East Coast. I was a scientist for almost 20 years doing Cold War kinds of research, then became a teacher and a professor. I then founded Rage Against the Media, as we were just talking about, because the media is so complicit in all the ills that we're facing right now. And also am past president of the Pacific Palisades Republican Club here in L.A.
And Tim Kelly.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a native Californian. I was born in San Francisco, and my parents and grandparents were, so we go back a long way. And I've got a pretty long memory. I've lived in Southern California, you know, since the mid-60s. But, you know, I've been an observer and a participant at one level or another with my late wife. In a lot of politics, and it's a fascinating game, and California is different than a lot of other places, different good and different bad.
At this moment in the state's history, because it appears to be overwhelmingly Democratic, at least its history in recent presidential elections, is California really just about getting money out of the state, whether you're a Republican who doesn't think you can win in California or you're a Democrat, it's in the bag. The principal role that California plays in election is this is where both parties come to get their money. Mark, you agree with that?
What do you mean by
any,
that exactly?
Are there any votes that are changed out here because of elections? Or is it just, I mean, this is where there's a lot of people with a lot of money. They like to be influential,
yeah.
So they come out here, but again, it's not likely that a presidential race is going to be competitive in this state in 2016.
You know, it depends. Is I guess sometimes elections are transformative, and sometimes there are realignments, as there was in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. Mm-hmm. We're going to need another candidate like a Ronald Reagan, somebody who can change hearts and minds, and that could change things in California. California is in horrible shape because the Democrats have been in charge for a long time. There's such an anti-business climate with the high taxes, the high regulations, the high environmental regulations, that businesses are leaving California in droves. And if that doesn't change, things are going to get worse. If we have a Republican running for office that articulates that fact, then things can change here in California.
Karen, I want to go back to you, and you, for those regular listeners to the show, you were on the broadcast last week. And during the course of the discussion, although it was not specifically about the fight for the heart and soul of the Republican Party, you said something in response to a question I had asked, and sort of I had sort of put the, you know, the battle, you know, within the party, you know, divided it up, I think, three ways.
Right.
And you came back and you said, no, no, and you went on and made a very important point that it's more of a three-way spread split in this party.
Four-way.
It's four or five. So tell it, repeat that for those who missed the broadcast last week.
Right. When we talk about the heart and soul of the Republican Party, people talk a lot about the establishment, which is sort of the original traditional Republicans.
But Wall Street Country Club.
Wall Street Country Club, who support the classic Republican, the old school Republicans. Obviously, we have the Tea Party in there now, which is reviving a lot of original aspects of the Republican Party, smaller government, more in terms of empowering the individual, this kind of attitude. We also have the Libertarian faction, which is really very different from the Tea Party, although mm-hmm. there is overlap, as there is across all four. And then, as you had mentioned, we have sort of the evangelical, the Christian right. So we've got sort of these four factions, but even across all four, we have what I sort of think of it as we have pragmatists, and then we also have ideological purists. And each one of these four has factions and has both of these, has the purists, the people who I will not vote for a candidate who doesn't believe mm-hmm. this, mm-hmm. or those who feel that whichever way it goes, even though they might be Tea Party, Libertarian, evangelical, they're fine with a more pragmatic approach.
Tim, what would you add to that? So first of all, do you agree with that four-way division,
think,
or would you add something to it?
I think there's a great deal of truth in that, but I would step back one to the two parties, and I would say Republican DNA, regardless of which faction, and regardless if it's Maine or California, Republicans are just, their DNA keeps them from wanting to raise taxes, whereas the Democrats are exact opposite. They have to be restrained to keep from raising taxes.
Does that DNA also include not favoring a increase in the minimum wage? Is that part of that DNA?
The whole minimum wage issue, I think it depends on how much. If you're going to allow a moderate, an incremental inflation-based raise every 2 years, I don't think there's much partisan. It's not worth the fight to trouble. What's going on now in the Democratic Party are some horrendous increases, which even PBS in their story on Seattle pointed out that this insane increase in minimum wage was destroying the nonprofits, destroying the very the base, and the Democrats up there didn't want it because it was way too much, and it was going to cost jobs, it was going to kill business, and this was dyed-in-the-wool, very liberal Democrats opposed to it. So, you know, it depends on how it's played. California's ultra-leftists are really crazy on this right now, but not even regular liberal Democrats are appalled by their logic.
Let's go to a call. Let's go to Max listening to us in Fresno, California. Go ahead. You're on the air.
You know, it seems to many of us out here that the West is using the same techniques all the way back to 1890, and we've lost our validity in the Western media, which most people believe is just nothing but a propaganda machine, you know, turning out the same old same old thing over and over. Nobody believes it. And then on the financial arena, you know, the same is going on. Rapidly, the petrodollar is using any validity at all. And I think while we're still fighting, you know, the old mechanisms, the rest of the world is totally circumventing the Western press and the petrodollar altogether.
All right. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Schaumburg, Illinois, where Joanne is listening to us on the Big 89 WLS out of Chicago.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to weigh in on the whole Benghazi incident and wonder if any of your guests remembered well over a year ago that CNN did an interview with a man from Benghazi who claimed to have information about the attack. Nobody followed up on it. Likewise, Russia warned us about the two Boston brothers, or the brothers who bombed Boston. Nobody followed up on it. Obama has failed to secure our borders. About 6 months ago, Al-Qaeda was arrested in the state of Washington trying to cross the border. I can't even fathom who's coming across the Mexican border. He has lied consistently to the American people. He has presented us, you know, in the world as a weak country now, putting us at risk.
But who in the Republican Party? Again, let's, for the sake of this discussion, Barack Obama is already a lame duck in the court of public opinion. He is a lame duck, and because you may be correct in all of your assessments, but no voter is ever going to be able to punish him or get back at him for what you believe he has done. So how does the Republican Party, how do they summarize, and how do they create, and how do they come up with a message? And equal to that message, who are the messengers, or messenger, if you have one, that you think can best crystallize some of these frustrations that you have? Name a name.
I think on the Benghazi incident, if they do put Trey Gowdy in charge of that select committee, the perfect person for it. I think he's a good messenger. You know, his messages are good. Mm-hmm. He will be out there with the truth. Now, the bottom line is, Bruce, what action could be taken? We saw Clinton get impeached for lying in a court of law, I believe, obstructing justice. What action could be taken against Obama for all that he has done to hurt this country?
The answer is, I don't think anything. I don't think there would be anyone out there, even Republican, the most partisan Republican, certainly at the congressional level, which is where they would start. I don't think there would be any interest in doing that, because they would view that it would be a waste of time, a waste of money, and I would agree with them. You know, he's going to be the president for another, you know, couple of half years.
Exactly.
I mean, we got to deal with it, and yet this program tonight is looking at how do you put the pieces together to come up with a message and a messenger that will get through, so that the next time there is an election for president in 2016, the Republican Party has they've got a good case to make. And if they have a good case to make, is the person at the head of that ticket, do they have the capability to make it? They'll certainly have the money to make it. I don't think anybody's going to doubt. Not going to be a tag day for whoever the Republican nominee is in 2016. Back shortly with more calls from Culver City. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We have talked a lot about issues this evening and what might be on the table for a little bit in 2014, but mostly about 2016. And I want to mention, based on your points, Karen, I put people into like four categories here, and I want to rattle off some names and let everyone sort of grasp these names, because I want to hear from you whether there's anybody in these lists that pops out from you. First of all, let's take a look at the governors. The Republicans have had most success in the last 50 years if they go in and they look for governors. So the governors whose names have been bantied about, and I'm going to throw some people, I'm going to expand these lists a little bit. Chris Christie, Scott Walker of Wisconsin, Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, Rick Perry appears to be making some sort of a comeback in Texas, Susan Martinez from New Mexico, and Nikki Haley from South Carolina. Now, some of these people may be more vice presidential, but their names that are in the mix, they're all governors. Now we got the D.C. squad. You got Senators Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Representative Paul Ryan. Those are the D.C. crowd. Then you've got the religious right fans, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee. And then you have, at the moment, the big kahuna, Jeb Bush. Now, is there anybody on that list, Tim, I'm going to start with mm-hmm. you. Is there anyone on that list at this moment in time that you would put at the head of the class as the one who would most likely be able to rally the various factions of the party together if the election was, you know, a month from now?
I think it's pretty clear that Jeb Bush would be that guy, because he's the heir. Everybody knows him. He's sort of like Hillary. The party guys know him. The donors know him. Everybody knows him. They trust him. He's not going to embarrass anybody. And a lot of people think he was the guy who should have been president, not his brother. So he's got a lot of strength there. But there's all the baggage that comes with being a Bush.
Mm-hmm. Mark, answer to the same question. Is there a name that pops out?
You know, first of all, I have to disagree a little bit with Jeb Bush. I agree with you on one thing. I think his chance was in 2000. It was either him or his brother. Now that there have been two Bushes in there, even if he'd make a great president, I don't think even the party loyals would go for Jeb Bush. I think it's going to be one of the governors. Someone like a Chris Christie, although a lot of folks don't like Chris Christie on the Republican side, I think that could change when they see that he's tough, that he's very articulate. Some of the other governors, I think Bobby Jindal's very strong. I think also Scott Walker could be. So I think maybe one of those three. Rick Perry of late is regaining strength, although I think he'd kind of fall flat on his face the way he did last time. I mean, he just took Toyota, who had been in California for years, and wooed them into Texas. And that's says a lot about, you know, his ability to help businesses and to build the economy in Texas. And if he can translate that into building the economy in the United States, he could be very strong.
Okay, Karen, that was a long answer to the question. I'm going to ask you for a shorter answer.
Sorry.
Who on the, that's all right. Who on the list? We have 2 hours to fill. Who on that list pops out as the most likely, again, remember the question, the most likely to bring all of the elements of the party together?
I really see Rick Perry as being the one who can galvanize more people in more of these factions. Yes, he fell on his face in that debate where he had the memory lapse. I also understand that that's because he had been lured into the arena too soon after having had surgery. Whether or not that matters, I don't know. But as far as a person who can cover, who can bring all four of these, if everyone's comfortable with those four, I think he is the guy, and he does have the jobs record. He has the religious record. He has a powerful economic record. He is very strong on states' rights, which
he's
is sort
an
of
outsider.
He's an outsider. So I absolutely, I
looks
think
looks a
he
little
can
bit like Ronald Reagan.
Looks
a little bit
really
of an aw shucks.
Has the eloquence of a Ronald Reagan when he's not on pain meds. He can also articulate values of conservatism better than anybody I know.
He sounds a little bit too much like George W. Bush, though. If
there
you close
is the whole
eyes,
Texas twang.
He's a Texan. He can't help
he is.
It.
Yeah.
I think if this is going to be an economic presidential, if the whole thing hinges on the economy, it really helps Perry, because Perry is the one guy who can point with pride at a state that's produces
successful.
One-third of our new jobs,
right.
At a state that's working.
We were also just talking about who who comes off as more sort of friendly and approachable, and we were talking about the dinner. That's Rick Perry. He's got that self-deprecating humor. He's got more of an sense of being able to engage
people. What is your thought? Because again, at least early on, it's who can get the big money going for mm-hmm. you to make you competitive. And certainly Rick Perry coming from Texas, even his campaign of, you know, a few years ago, which was not successful, he didn't run out of money.
Right.
He ran out of memory at a debate. So
yes.
That's not his problem. But there was a story last week in the New York Times, and I want to get reaction then when we go to the next hour of this, and that is the amount of money that Rand Paul is picking up
mm-hmm.
From many of the libertarians mm-hmm. around the country. And I want to talk more about this list, and I want to find out whether there's names that should be added or deleted from that list. And we will talk about this. We'll continue this discussion in the next hour. But when we come back after the network news, we're going to switch gears for a little bit, and we're going to talk about some Democratic politics, and we're going to ask the question, what happens if Hillary Clinton doesn't run? We have someone that's done some looking into one name that may pop up, Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, and we will hear about her and your calls when we continue from Culver City. I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8289, from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night. This is Beyond the Beltway.
Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Tim Kelly, Mark Vaviades, Karen Sigmund, and special guest in this hour, Rebecca Berg, who is a political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Our program tonight coming to you from the Westwood One Studios in Culver City, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you want to tweet us a question, it's at btbdumont. In the first hour, we were talking about the future of the Republican Party. We will come back to that and name names and come up with some of the cast of characters that will be parading before you on their way to at least what they hope is a residence at 1600 North Pennsylvania Avenue. But it has been a foregone conclusion to most in the political world that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee, and all she has to say is, yes, I want to do it, and it's all hers. Rebecca Berg joins us. She is political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. She joins us from Washington, and she has brought up the question, or has addressed the question, what happens if Hillary says no, and what happens to the Democrats? So, Rebecca, is there one single person that everyone is going to rush to, and is that person Joe Biden, or is it somebody else?
Hi, Bruce. Good to be with you. I'm not sure people would rush to Joe Biden, but I think if someone in the Democratic Party is going to have a viable chance of defeating Hillary Clinton, who, as you mentioned, is a powerhouse, many people assume she will just sweep in and take the nomination if she wants it. I think the person who could bring a challenge to Clinton would be Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts. She holds a very unique niche within the party as this progressive hero. And I think that progressives are not necessarily thrilled about Clinton in the way that they would be excited about Elizabeth Warren, potentially.
But hasn't she said that she would not challenge Hillary Clinton?
She has said in the past that she is not running for president. But if you look back to 2006, then-Senator Barack Obama was at this time in that election cycle saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until October of 2006 that he came out on Meet the Press and said he would actually think about potentially running for president, and then that kind of opens the floodgates. So Elizabeth Warren saying right now that she is not planning to run is by no means an indicator that necessarily she won't. She could very well change her mind, and there really wouldn't be any negative implications from doing so.
I want to ask you, and I also want to ask our guests around the studio here in California, the question that we spent very little time on maybe about a month ago on this program is, at this particular moment, why wouldn't Hillary Clinton run? Karen, I'm going to let you tackle this one. Let's try to get inside her head and figure out, would she take a pass on this?
I really don't see Hillary Clinton running at all, to be honest. I think a lot of people look to the age. I think that is a factor. I don't think that's the main factor. I do think the huge target that will be on her back because of Benghazi will play a role. I think the increased turmoil in the Middle East generally with her Arab Spring will play a role. The fact that during her tenure, the world became a more dangerous place rather than a safer one, in particular for Americans, that will play a role. I don't see her entering the fray at all.
Mark.
I think the only way she wouldn't run is if there was a health or age issue, as Karen mentioned, Benghazi. But the other thing is this. She will run if she thinks she can win. If she, for some reason, looks at the numbers and thinks that she doesn't think she could win, almost guaranteed, she's not going to run. That's the only reason.
Tim?
I would agree that if it is, she has to fight. If it's going to be a tooth and nail fight, it's not worth it. Mm-hmm. Plus, I would, agreeing with both of you, I think the last part of her tenure as Secretary of State and the first 4 or 5 months when she was out of office, her health was in very, very dicey condition. And obviously, that's the most important thing. Is she physically able, or does she want to risk it? She was in horrible physical shape at the end of her term as Secretary of State.
And she has a grandchild coming up, too.
Yeah, I think that's the point. I'm glad somebody brought that point up, because my answer to the question, then I want to get Rebecca's response. My answer would be, at this moment in time, if she does nothing else, she is a historic figure in American politics.
If she runs, there's the possibility that she could lose, mm-hmm. and the glow would be off, somewhat tarnished. I think that she is about to be a grandmother, a right. new role. She is older. She is perhaps wiser. She knows the rigors of a campaign. She knows she's been through it, and she knows physically and emotionally and mentally how difficult mm-hmm. it is. And the other piece is, and this is something that Rand Paul has hinted at, he is going to make Bill Clinton mm-hmm. an issue. And I'm not so sure as a human being that she wants it so bad that there's going to be this regurgitation of many of the real unseemly aspects of Bill Clinton that are going to be thrust. Again, some of it will land up on her, although she's a different person. And also, she is a grandmother, and there's going to be a grandchild, and there's a child involved, Chelsea. To make Chelsea go through all of that again, I think above everything else, Hillary Clinton is a woman, yes, a mother, yes, a grandmother about to be, and I would not be surprised if she took a pass. Mm-hmm. All right, those are the responses mm-hmm. from California. Rebecca, back to you. What do you think?
Well, Bruce, I think you all have brought up some very pertinent points, and especially the point that Hillary Clinton would need to come to terms with the idea of running and potentially losing again. She is not someone who loves to campaign, and she certainly didn't love the act of running for president last time around. She likes the idea of being president without having to actually go through the rigors of a campaign. And now that she's that much older, that is, you know, that much more of a taxing thing on her body and her mind. So I think that's certainly a consideration for her. It's something that her allies have raised with her, that she has this amazing legacy. She just had a fairly decent term as Secretary of State and has a very, you know, a legacy that she can be proud of. And so why does she need to run for president again and go through this process that she hates? And I think she'll be thinking about that. But I think also if you see yourself leading in polls by as much as she is right now, she's getting 60 or 70 points among the Democratic field in many polls. I think that's also hard to ignore and would suggest that the nominating process wouldn't be as tough as it was for her last time.
But do you think also that she might be looking at some of the matchups against some Republicans? And at least one poll that I saw, although Jeb Bush does not have the nomination, Jeb Bush was pretty competitive with her, and I was surprised that even Rand Paul was somewhat competitive. I was only about 4 points behind her, which kind of surprised me.
I'm sure, and I'm sure she's considering that as well. It's hard to put too much stock in those early polls because really a lot of it is just based off of people's vague impression of who these people are as candidates and mm-hmm. Their name ID in a lot of cases with the Republicans. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to put too much stock in that, but I'm sure she's considering it. I'm sure she was not disappointed by the way the scandal exploded in New Jersey for Chris Christie,
right.
Who was thought to be in a very good position entering the presidential race.
Yeah, so. Also the numbers for Christie look very good as well. Stay on the line with Rebecca. We're going to take some calls. We've got some people coming in, want to weigh in on this conversation. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border tonight, live from Culver City, California. From Peabody, Massachusetts to Lexington, Kentucky, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Let's go to St. Charles, Illinois, where Hector is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hector, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to make a point about Elizabeth Warren running for president.
Good. Rebecca Berg is standing by. Go ahead.
Well, it's just that, you know, she's the original, if you have a business, you didn't build that, politician. And after 8 years of the Obama economy, the weak recovery from the recession, I think the American people are ready to move on from that type of talk.
Well, I think the question that I would kind of expand on your question, if I may, and Rebecca will let you tackle this first, and that is, whether or not we have on the horizon an election that could be, a Clinton against a Bush. And what would that do for turnout? What would that do for defining the parties? And how would the Democratic Party, which at least, you know, 8 years ago was talking about freshness and newness, I mean, how do you send as the messenger? That message won't work with her as the messenger.
Right. I think if you have the prospect of a Clinton versus a Bush in this election, that might actually make Elizabeth Warren a little more appealing to people, because she could lay claim to being an outsider, to not being this longtime Washington name like the Clintons, like the Bushes. So something a little bit new. Although, as this caller pointed out, she does lay claim to this "you didn't build that" mentality, I think she can also lay claim to taking on big institutions that people really dislike, like banks and Wall Street. There was a recent poll of Democrats in the Washington Post that showed among Democrats, about 50% feel personally victimized by big businesses, and that's kind of the niche that Elizabeth Warren would be able to appeal to.
What are some of the other, some of the personal aspects of her life and what she has done thus far during her campaign in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and her term in the U.S. Senate right now that would, you know, already has some people talking about the possibility of her running for president of the United States? What's unique about her that the public may not know?
Well, she has not been in politics for very long. This is the first elected office she has ever held as senator from Massachusetts. And before that, she was a longtime law professor who focused on bankruptcy issues. And that's how she came to be involved as a consumer advocate against the big banks, especially after the financial crash in 2008. And so she came on and started to help Congress in drafting Dodd-Frank. She came on to lead a Consumer Protection Bureau that was institutionalized as part of that bill. And so that is her pre-politics resume that I think will actually be very attractive to a lot of people, because it shows she was never in this to run for office necessarily. Mm-hmm. This is just truly a passion project of hers, mm-hmm. defending people from these big institutions and moneyed interests. So it's a very populist sort of thing.
Mark Viviades is with us. He is the chairman of the Los Angeles County Republican Party. And as you were speaking, to describing some of her positives, he was sort of shaking his head. I take it that you have a different perspective of what sort of a candidate. Would she be a pushover candidate?
Good? She, first of all, I'm originally from Massachusetts.
Right.
Elizabeth Warren is a
And you worked for William Weld.
Yes, I did.
A very liberal Republican.
Yes, I wouldn't call him liberal. He was a libertarian Republican.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and that was the
before it was fashionable.
Before it was fashionable, and that was the 80s libertarian, not the libertarians of today. In any event, Elizabeth Warren is a real lightweight. She didn't have that distinguished a career. She wasn't that great a law professor. As a matter of fact, when she got into the college where she worked, she used the fact that she was Native American, but she was only 1/32nd Native American. In addition to that, she as a politician, she's not at all dynamic. If they choose her as the nominee, it'll be like the Democrats when they chose George McGovern, because she's the leftist of the left. And right now, the leftists are in control of the Democrat Party, and that's the only way she's going to get nominated.
Let's go to Joe in Gurnee, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on there, Joe.
Yeah, hi. I think that an old scandal of bills is going to come back and bite Hillary. Remember the Waco catastrophe?
Yes.
Bill was part of the planning of that raid. He had to sign the Posse Comitatus Act waiver that allowed the tanks to be brought in when they raided the compound.
I'm not so sure that will have much impact. Yeah.
Everyone in that compound at risk, as well as the law enforcement officers who died.
Well, I'm not so sure that there would be much focus on that because, again, Hillary was not involved in it. But, again, it brings up the issue, and I want to ask everyone around the table here first, because the person that took this on head-on was Rand Paul. Rand Paul said that if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, that there should be a focus on Bill Clinton. He described him as a serial, a womanizer, abuser, actually.
I think
the question is Is Bill Clinton fair game in a race for president?
I think he's fair game, but I think that'll backfire on Rand Paul. And I say that unfortunately because I'm a Republican. I don't think the press will allow that. I think they're going to say this is Hillary Clinton, it's not Bill Clinton running, and I don't think the press is going to go with that. And I think, unfortunately for us, that's going to backfire on Rand Paul.
Karen, your thought?
Yeah, I agree.
Isn't the spouse of the presidential candidate an issue no matter what? Because certainly we all know that Michelle Obama has some impact on her husband, so why would it not work the other way, especially when Bill Clinton used to say, you vote for me, you get us both?
Well, exactly. That's what I was harking back to. It was exactly Bill Clinton's own words that this is a twofer deal, right? Isn't that what he said? If you vote for me, you get two of us. I think absolutely we should at the very least speak loudly that we will do that. He opened the door for that. On the other hand, I agree that the media won't allow it. But in the days, weeks, months ramping up to this, let's be clear that he is fair game.
How about the tabloids?
Tabloids that broke the John Edwards story?
How about the tabloids and how about the cable news operations? Will they let the past of Bill Clinton go undealt with in a campaign if Hillary is the president?
It's already happening. Bill's past is already coming back to the front burner right now. So I think that will continue. And I think the more issues we can bring up now that make her do this calculus that we were just talking about, is it really worth it? This is going to be very, very difficult. She's got the health issues. She's got all these other things. The more things that we can bring up now that make her decide to just, you know, sit this one out, to say, look, I've got this grandchild coming. I'm going to enjoy my older years and be a grandmother.
Tim.
The vision of Bill Clinton in the East Wing going from luncheon to tea is almost hysterical. The guy would go crazy.
Someone's got to screen the interns, though.
Right. The thing of what to do with Bill Clinton in a Hillary White House, outside of making an ambassador to New Zealand or something, it's pretty scary.
Well, it was scary the role in which he played in the campaign. And again, we cannot forget, I mean, once upon a time, Hillary Clinton was the inevitable candidate, and everyone was talking about the inevitability and the brilliance of the two Clintons together. How could anyone undo that? And what we have here is we have, with the race in 2008, with these two brilliant people, we have the biggest political collapse in the history of modern presidential politics. I mean, a complete, you know, from the mountaintop down into the trenches.
Hey, Bruce, we've got to remember though, Bill Clinton is still one of the most popular politicians in America. So I think he'd be more of an asset than a liability to Hillary.
To what extent do you believe your colleagues in the media, Rebecca, back in inside the Beltway there? To what extent would they give Bill Clinton a pass, and would they view any attempts to bring up some of the his indiscretions of the past, they would view it as yesterday's news, and they'd yawn and they'd look the other way?
You know, I disagree that they would give him a pass, and this isn't me defending the media necessarily, but I think that the media and American voters will think of Bill in the White House as an extension of Hillary were she to become president. That is the way that the Clinton White House worked when Bill Clinton was president. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton, of course, had a very active policy role, was a trusted advisor to her husband, and they have obviously carried on that relationship in their private and professional lives since then, to say nothing of their personal relationship. So I think that the media will actually be very interested in what kind of first man he would be, what level of activity he would have in the White House. And so I think that sort of vetting will be very appropriate, and you'll see a lot of that by the media.
A comparison that I would make is Donald Sterling, the former owner of the Los Angeles Clippers. If you were a follower of the NBA or if you were a reader of a newspaper, you had to know that someday Donald Sterling was going to blow up. And everyone knew, I believe in the NBA, they knew the person they were dealing with, and it blew up, and they were embarrassed by it. I cannot believe there are not a significant number of Democratic political leaders all over the United States that if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, would go to sleep every night worried when, not if, when Bill Clinton is going to say something, do something, or there's going to be some scandalous activity that will once again remind everybody of the disgraceful conduct that he performed in the White House that really dragged it got to the point where people couldn't even watch the news together as a family, and I think people will be repelled by that. Back shortly from Culver City. From Tallahassee, Florida to Sacramento, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. This evening, around the table at Culver City in California, Tim Kelly is here. He is a Navy veteran, having served in Vietnam, a former staffer in the Los Angeles County Republican Party, and now a direct mail executive. And he is one of our guests this evening, a Republican, as well as Mark Vaviades. He is the chairman of the Republican Party of Los Angeles County. And Karen Sigmund also joins us. She is the founder and director of the activist organization Rage Against the Media and the past president of the Pacific Palisades Republican Club. And joining us on the phone is Rebecca Berg, who is political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, and she's been talking about Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, as someone who's perhaps waiting in line should Hillary Clinton decide not to run. One last question, Rebecca, to you, and then we'll let you get on with your calendar of events for this evening.
Sure.
Earlier in the broadcast, I gave somewhat of a tirade against the White House correspondents' dinner. Did you go to the dinner?
I didn't go to the dinner, no. Just
okay.
Some of the events surrounding it, but
okay.
Not the dinner itself.
Why is it, and again, I'm asking this question to speak to your colleagues there, not necessarily that you're of the political stripe that would, take exception to what I'm about to say, but why is it that so many people inside the Beltway believe, I mean, major decision makers, primarily at the network Sunday morning shows, why do they believe that the average person out in beyond the Beltway, why do they think that we would be so interested in having so much airtime spent on watching people who make news have dinner and socializing with people that are supposed to be covering them objectively?
That is an excellent question. I think that the coverage of the event has expanded as it has become filled with more celebrities and celebrity appearances. And I think that is where people assume the interest of the public lies, and seeing some of these movie stars coming in and socializing with each other. But I don't think there's necessarily a lot of interest with the American public regarding the media here in D.C. and watching us, my colleagues, eat dinner. But,
do you think,
I mean,
the quality aspect
is refreshing for people. They like to see the president give his speech. They like to see the host make fun of Washington. Whenever Washington is the butt of the joke, I think people are interested.
Do any of your colleagues, do any of them have discussions amongst yourself as to whether or not collectively there's a perception that those that cover the White House are too cozy with the White House? Does that concern anyone? I know the New York Times doesn't let its people go there. Are there other periodicals that do that? And what's, amongst your friends that are reporters, does anybody think twice that maybe that doesn't look good?
You know, some do, and the New York Times is the only publication I know of that has a strict rule against his reporters actually attending the dinner. But I don't think that the dinner is necessarily the most cozy reporters in the White House get. And actually, as the focus has shifted off of the correspondents themselves, it's become less of an opportunity for them to schmooze with people in the White House anyway. So There was one article in the Washington Post this week that I thought was very illustrative of the relationship between reporters and the White House. And it talks about this one reporter from McClatchy who has reported for years on the White House and has asked the president a question one time, a single time in years. And her friends think she's very cozy with administration officials, think she has this amazing access. But actually,
she has no idea what the prison is like. And for most of the media, that's actually the case. They have really limited access, and there isn't a whole lot of coziness there.
Okay. I thank you very much. You presented the rebuttal to my tirade about 40 minutes ago. But thank you very much for being with us. That was Rebecca Berg. She is the political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, and she's written a story, What If Hillary Isn't the One? And again, you can read it if you go to Washington Examiner. And again, Rebecca, thanks for being with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Thank you, Bruce.
Let us move on to a call. Let's go to George listening to us in Lincoln, Nebraska. Go ahead. You're on the air, Lincoln.
Well, thanks, Bruce. I hope that I don't insult you guys too badly, but
go ahead.
You're just whistling in the dark about Bill Clinton. I'm afraid you Republicans don't have anybody to run against Hillary, so you're trying to pick up any.
Hello. Go ahead.
Okay. Go ahead.
You were saying, go ahead. We got a little beep on the line. We were not cutting you off, but you were about to make your point. Go ahead. You think we're whistling in the dark about Bill Clinton?
Yeah, Bill Clinton was the last president we had that had a budget surplus. We had a booming economy. I think things were moving along well. The Republicans tried to pick up a little indiscretion there and turn it into a impeachment that I think backfired on them.
Do you mean Newt Gingrich's surplus?
What's that?
Do you mean Newt Gingrich's surplus? Oh. Sorry, keep going. I'm sorry.
He might have thought.
Oh, I'm sorry. You rewrote history, huh?
No, actually I didn't, but keep going.
It was because of the policies that Ronald Reagan put in place, and then Newt Gingrich and his Congress helped.
Reagan against him, go ahead, but you got nobody else.
But let me ask you just the bigger question, though, because it would be a unique situation in American political history that the spouse of the presidential candidate was as well known or perhaps even more well known than the candidate. That has never ever happened before.
And
let me just finish my point, and then I'm going to give you the last word on it. In a presidential campaign, we are always introduced to the wife or the spouse of the candidate, and we learn about them, and they get massive coverage generally during the primaries, and certainly if they're in the final, if they're the nominee of the party, or they're the vice presidential nominee of the party, their husbands get lots of ink and lots of coverage, and everybody wants to know everything about them. So I don't know how anyone would say that, okay, Bill Clinton is running and he will be the first husband. I can't believe that there wouldn't be 10 times the coverage of Bill Clinton in a campaign. There would probably be more coverage of Bill Clinton in the campaign than maybe even the husband or even the vice presidential running mate of the Republican nominee. So it's you cannot do a Google search or a Nexus search on Bill Clinton and find 100% positive press on the guy. So he's going to be an issue. I think it's it is not an issue that the media can ignore. And I do believe that when Rand Paul brought that subject up about a month ago or 6 weeks ago, I think he knew it was a calculated comment that he made about Bill Clinton, that Bill Clinton will be an issue in the campaign. And frankly, I think it was a shot across the bow to Hillary Clinton that if she thinks that Bill Clinton's indiscretions of the past are somehow going to be ignored by him if he's the nominee, forget it.
Well, and I don't know, can you do the same thing to Ron Paul's father?
Absolutely. No, you could, and you should. Now, by the way, I want to make one clear point here. I do not believe that the sins of Bill Clinton, and I'm not saying this in a religious way, the indiscretions, the sins, the public conduct, private conduct of Bill Clinton, I do not believe that Hillary Clinton has to answer for that. It's not her. She is embarrassed. She was embarrassed. The public knows that she was embarrassed. Every woman, I think, knows that she was embarrassed. I think it's part of her strong popularity. But if that is the particular case, that she was embarrassed, then I think it becomes yet another problem for Bill Clinton in a campaign and for her.
Well, I think she showed a great deal of strength, and I think the women
she
of the
did.
Country mm-hmm. appreciate her.
She did. And by the way, just to button up your point, I don't think you could say the same thing about the policies. I don't think you should put on Rand Paul all of the policies of Ron Paul. They are two different people. They are two different people. And Ron Paul, you may think that Ron Paul has some really goofy ideas. And many people, maybe even around this table, would think that's the case. But Rand Paul will be defending things about his father, whether it is fair or not.
And so will Hillary.
Yes, that's true. I agree with that. Anyway, we're going to thank you for your call. We're going to move to Elmhurst, Illinois, and it's Glenn listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. Listen, we're talking about Hillary Clinton and we're talking about Jeb Bush, but really, Hillary Clinton, after what we saw her performance involved with Benghazi and, you know, how she lied to even the families of the people as the remains were being taken off the airplanes, that can't be forgotten. Right. Now, as far as Jeb Bush is concerned, again, when he made that comment about illegals coming across the borders based on the fact that they love their families, what these things show us is that no matter who we elect for the presidency, either party, things are not going to change. We have problems in this country now that are much, much greater than we can solve, either by who we elect at the federal level, I think, or by the laws, or by changing laws passed by Congress. I think that my main point would be, I really think we should start considering seriously this idea of the Convention of the States that Mark Levin has been advocating so vociferously mm-hmm. lately. The federal government has gotten way too powerful. The states need to call for a convention. We need amendments to the Constitution, and the states need to reassume their responsibility.
Is there, I got 5 seconds for the answer. Is there a candidate you can name that you are most excited about right now?
I would say either Rick Perry or else the governor of Wisconsin. I think
Scott Walker.
Scott Walker, yeah.
Okay, thanks for your call, 1-800-723-8289. We're going to talk more about politics when we come back. Bruce Dumont back in Culver City, California, and before we go back and continue our conversation, I do want to just take a moment so I don't run out at the end of the program before the theme comes blaring in, and I really want to thank David Felker from Westwood One in Culver City, and Corey Irwin, who's been our engineer for virtually all of our shows out here, and Jim Smith, who's been helping us for the last couple of weeks, and really they've done Tim Woods, who is away on China at the moment, but he was screening our calls for a long time. We've been out here for much of the last 3 months doing our programs from California. We'll be heading back to Chicago for most of the rest of the year, but I didn't want to run out of time without thanking them for the terrific job. They've made me feel very comfortable here in California, and we've also developed a lot of new good friends on both sides of the political aisle, some of whom are with us tonight, talking about a California perspective to national politics. I want to go back, so thank you all. I want to go back to some of these names that we talked about. You said, and you said it off the air, so let me put it on the record, Mark. You said that if there are people that you could almost instantly cross off this list of about 15 names that I mentioned, you would put Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee off the list as viable candidates. And mm-hmm. you made the strong case, Karen, that if you looked at the three or four different elements of the party, the one that could probably bring all of those elements together would be Rick Perry.
Right.
More so even than Jeb Bush, because you think there's real strong animosity towards Jeb Bush.
I see. Mm-hmm. One way he does seem to bring groups together is against him, is what I see personally. I see a lot of animosity towards Jeb Bush.
When we talk about the one name that we haven't mentioned, although he's done very well in some of the most recent polls, and we've talked about on this program who's getting sort of the hot property at the moment, and that is Rand Paul. Where would you put Rand Paul on the viability list of who is a likely candidate? I want to get your response and then everybody else's.
I see him as as an early favorite for, obviously, for a lot of groups. He comes in number one in a lot of polls, especially ones that include young people. I see him as a huge, huge draw to young people. It's CPAC. He was number one by a mile. He's been speaking on college campuses and rallying them to libertarian, get the government out of my life kind of issue. And I think that's incredibly important. But I don't know that he has any real staying power.
Tim Kelly.
I think Rand Paul, I believe, it is a compelling figure, but I don't, and almost for sure a VP choice, but I just don't see him actually taking the nomination at this point. One, for lack of enough of the money base and a lack of people in the party. And also, he's still a very, very young man. And the Republicans...
Is he somewhat like Ronald Reagan... that he is on a long-term march to the Republican nomination and a transformation of the party on libertarian issues. And although we're talking about 2016, he may be thinking 20 or 24 because he's got age on his side.
I agree absolutely. And I think Marco Rubio is another one who's on the long march like Reagan was. And the Republican Party, unlike the Dems, you've got to run... and lost at least once to get the nominee. We don't take neophytes.
Well. Paul Ryan has won or run and lost, not in the nomination, but he certainly was not a stellar vice presidential candidate. Is he yesterday's news, Mark?
I think Paul Ryan is yesterday's news. As far as Rand Paul goes, we were talking about that. He's gonna inherit the fanatical followers of Ron Paul. But because he's not as, I hate to use this word, wacky as Ron Paul, and I'm sorry for those Ron Paul fans, I don't really mean it that way. Because he's not, I think more people, other than just the Ron Paul fanatics, will take him more seriously. I don't think he has a chance this time out. Maybe in the future if he distinguishes himself in the Senate.
Right. I think he's one of the Republicans that not only can get younger people, I think he's one of the people that actually could get people that don't vote or are Democrats to vote for a Republican because of some of the things
he's
saying.
Watching him at Berkeley.
Yeah.
A month or two ago.
He's charismatic.
It was phenomenal. This was Berkeley, and he was there in his jeans and his cowboy boots, looking like an associate professor, and he had the kids eating out of his hand. It was really a performance.
Now, let's see. Who did that a few years ago? Who had those same abilities?
Right.
But Ron Paul has the kids eating out of his hand, too, but he didn't go very far.
Right.
At this particular moment, Susan Martinez and Nikki Haley, and I will ask our female member of our panel this evening, are they mentioned because they are really ideal vice presidential candidates, or do you think someone believes, people with a lot of money believe, that a woman could emerge as the viable nominee of the party?
I don't see either of those emerging as a nominee, but I do... And yes, there are a lot of people who say, what we really need is a woman, you know, candidate. I reject that idea completely, that we need anybody of a certain demographic to represent us.
If Hillary is on the Democratic side, does it increase the likelihood of a female running mate?
It may be that more people, as if everybody says yes, then yes. Then that's exactly what it does.
Bobby Jindal. Serious or?
I think very serious. He's a very impressive guy. He speaks well. He's dynamic. He's done a great job in his state.
Chris Christie, dead meat or not?
Too soon to tell.
Yeah, he's not down for the count quite yet.
Could come back. If we said an hour ago on this program that Rick Perry can make a comeback from his fall a few years ago when he last ran for president, then clearly Chris Christie may have the ability to clean up the mess.
It would be reluctant on people's part. I don't think he's anybody's real first choice.
A second choice.
I think he's got a chance.
On that point of disagreement, I want to thank our guests this evening for being with us. I want to thank Mark Viviades for being with us, the chairman of the Los Angeles Republican Party. Tim Kelly, thank you very much. And also Karen Sigmund from Rage Against the Media. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WS Radio and Westwood One. This week, our thanks to Corey Irwin and James Smith. Todd Nebel back in Chicago. And again, a special thanks to David Felker for making this program possible. Until next week at this same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Culver City.